sweet information. Something like that. That's what I'm thinking.
Well, I think that that sounds good, but the problem with that particular musical instrument, what is that, a melodica? Is that you can't sing while you're playing it, so
yeah,
there's a slight discord between when you're playing and then all of a sudden you start singing.
I guess that's true. I also don't play it very well.
Yeah, that might have something to do with it.
Okay, so okay. All right. I agree.
Maybe we should just take that and smash it then.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't see you listening there. This is John Hodgman. I'm here with Jonathan Colton, broadcasting to you from the Trident, Jonathan's opulent luxury submarine as it plies the dark and inky waters of the East River. We were just working on a new theme song, as you probably remember. We're working on a new Little Gray Book lecture to debut this February, and so we want to get the theme song ready to go. And we're also thinking about some of the lectures of the past. Jonathan, I seem to recall a lecture, from March or so of 2004.
Yes.
And it was called Secret of the Secret Agents. If I'm correct, it was number 26.
I think you are correct, John, yeah.
And David Guillaume spoke very eloquently on the subject of spies, as did several other people. And I'd like you to have a chance to hear it now, if we can dial it up on the Aqua Memory phone, and you can listen to him talk about spies. And at one point, he makes a reference to a slide. We sometimes, at these Little Gray Book lectures, use visual aids and slides to give the unconscious brain a cue that the conscious brain can't hear in mere words. And in this case, so that you're not left behind, the slide in particular was a picture of David Guillaume as a teenager lying in the grass wearing a fedora. So when the slide comes on and you hear the wild applause of everyone's unconscious brain registering this amazing image, you should maybe start sketching for yourself now a picture of David Guillaume lying in the grass wearing a fedora. Dial it up. I think you need to turn that handle.
Yeah, I'll punch that up here.
Right. Or turn the handle.
Yeah. Thank you. This essay is entitled My Second Favorite Obsession. Spy rock is a subgenre of pop music from the early 1980s, about which one of three things may be true. One, it does not exist. Two, it does exist, but only in my mind. And three, it exists, and its existence is not only widely known to everyone except me, but so expertly described elsewhere by an actual aficionado of early 80s pop music that my lecture tonight will be a complete waste of time. I would like to point out that I'm almost related to an actual spy. Dr. Ray S. Klein was my grandfather's best friend from childhood. Ray grew up on the wrong side of the tracks in Terre Haute, Indiana, and when he was awarded a full scholarship to Harvard, he had to jump a freight train like a hobo to get there. When World War II broke out, Ray joined the Office of Strategic Services, the predecessor of the CIA. He would later become the CIA's Deputy Director of Intelligence. And in 1962, he was the one to inform President Kennedy that there were Russian missiles in Cuba. Ray also taught me how to play badminton, at which I remain undefeated. And he wrote me two letters. The first letter was a reply to a letter I wrote him when I was 10 years old and doing some of my early research for a report for the Gifted Program. On my second favorite obsession, spying. My questions elicited from Ray a series of very professional, sober, and disappointing responses. But handwritten at the bottom were these words. In response to number 10 above, in some extreme cases, it might be necessary. Question number 10, inspired by a drawing in one of my books of a spy in a trench coat crawling around through the grass, was, is it ever necessary for spies to crawl around through the grass? Ray's postscript was tantalizing. The second letter that Ray wrote me was a letter of recommendation when I applied to Harvard in 1989. He informed his alma mater that I was a fine young man and reminded them of his credentials and I was accepted. I came east from Illinois to visit several colleges, including both Harvard and Yale. It was a whirlwind tour during which I absorbed a number of detailed impressions. Upon returning home, I thought carefully about all that I had seen and decided to go to Yale. The following fall, when I stepped out of a van with my suitcases in downtown New Haven, my vivid memories of the Charles River, red brick Georgian architecture, and pleasantly bourgeois Cambridge, Massachusetts, were hurriedly recategorized in the Harvard folder. Right, I said, Yale, New Haven. Right. So, as you can see, I am not a spy. The details which I remember tend to be irrelevant, or at best, organized according to an idiosyncratic system dictated by some perverse psychological need disguised as an intellectual pursuit. Which brings me to a book called The 36 Dramatic Situations by George Pulte, in which the author attempts to classify all possible stories in the universe under 36 archetypal situations. The book is an example of that taxonomic tendency of thought whose finest instantiations are the cabinets of curiosity of the 17th century, which became today's museums, and whose less fine instantiations are the paintings you have seen in exhibitions of art by the mentally ill, in which every area not filled by the main figure must be filled by smaller figures, and the area around those filled by still smaller figures ad infinitum, a kind of graphic tic born of horror vacui. The 36 Dramatic Situations by George Pulte seems to have as its premise that we will somehow understand King Lear better if we are told that it is an example of dramatic situation number 6, disaster. Subcategory C1, by the way, ingratitude suffered. Or that classifying Oedipus the king as one of a particular family, genus, and species of conflict will help us plumb its depths. In case you're curious, Oedipus is dramatic situation number 18, involuntary crimes of love. Subcategory A1, discovery that one has married one's mother. It's probably safe to say that we all can intuit that these butterflies, pinned to a card and labeled, are not more engaging than they were in flight, free and unclassified. And one begins to wonder about George Pulte sitting alone in his garret, carefully organizing and reorganizing his books. Was his true aim not somewhat darker? Was it not really somehow to do away with them all? Another fact of note about the 36 Dramatic Situations by George Pulte is that, aside from a few classics by heavy hitters like Shakespeare and Sophocles, the bulk of his examples are culled from the obscure, not for the ages, French literature he apparently had a lot of on his shelf, writers like Rabier and Moustier and Denard, none of whom was original enough, apparently, to come up with dramatic situation number 37. So George Pulte considers his chance browsings to be worthy of an eminent chapter in the book of all past and future knowledge. Can you imagine? Let us return to my memories of the early 80s. What, if anything, is spy rock? My first favorite obsession, when I was 10 years old, was not spying, but rather the Middle Ages, about which I wrote my other now classic report for the Gifted program, and which I took to include not only knights and castles, but also the Lord of the Rings. Some call this realm fantasy. If there is a genre of rock and roll music we could call fantasy rock, and if that genre reaches its ultimate and most typical moment when the lead singer of Led Zeppelin refers to both Mordor and Gollum in a song called Ramble On, then spy rock is to fantasy rock as Top Secret is to Dungeons and Dragons. That is to say, spy rock is its second-tier cousin, referring, as fantasy rock does, to stock images, but images whose history is more recent and whose symbolic underpinnings are less profound. The assassin, rather than the epic hero. Fantasy rock is swords, warriors, and the cover of Asia's self-titled album on which a dragon leaps from the sea, its talons clawing a spinning silver orb. Spy rock is thin neckties, fedoras, and linen sport coats with the sleeves pushed up. It is metal briefcases, hotel rooms, and sunglasses at night. It is airplane travel and musical instrument cases. It is assassination. It is the enjoyment of alienation. In the course of my research, I have discovered that spy rock is a genre of which there is only one pure example, composed of one song and one image, a dark binary star, if you will, collapsing into a singularity. Yet there exist many more songs and images orbiting, as it were, around this black hole, which shed the light on it necessary for us to see that it exists. I am saving this one image and one song until the end, and for the rest, we will rely on the power of the imagination. Without this entire constellation of theatrical data, these lyrics, band names, album and song titles, art, costumes, and music videos, spy rock could not exist. So I will define spy rock by describing this scattered constellation. The time period we are concerned with is the early 1980s, which for our purposes extends as far back in time as 1841, when Edgar Allan Poe wrote The Murders in the Rue Morgue and invented the detective story. And it stretches as far forward as 1986, when an event occurred, which I shall mention later. So, what makes up this constellation of spy rock, and why? The band The Police is spy rock, by virtue of their name alone, leaving aside the song Murder by Numbers, though I must add that the lead singer's name is indisputably fantasy rock. Glenn Frey's Smuggler's Blues is spy rock. So is Phil Collins' In the Air Tonight. And not only for its and his appearance on the TV show Miami Vice, whose theme music, by Jan Hammer, is also spy rock. Duran Duran's Girls on Film is spy rock for its voyeurism. Greg Kinn's Our Love's in Jeopardy is spy rock for its sense of danger and for the narrowness of his necktie in the video. Though the tentacled beast that drags him from the altar at his wedding in the same video is fantasy rock. By the way, the ultimate straddler between the spy and fantasy rock genres is Jethro Tull's Aqualung. The guitar in that song is as rough-hewn as Stonehenge, and is thus fantasy rock. But the alienated loner watching little girls at a public park is but one non-government-sanctioned step away from the secret agent crawling around through long grasses in his trench coat, and is thus spy rock. I will discuss the remainder of fantasy rock, including the Molly Hatchet album cover featuring the barbarian warrior standing over a heap of slain foes wielding a bloody battle axe, at an unspecified future time. Suffice it to say that the terms of fantasy rock are ancient, archaic, and profound, while the terms of spy rock are modern, sophisticated, and neurotic. Billy Ocean's Caribbean Queen is spy rock for its sense of the erotic power of travel and cocktails. Corey Hart's Sunglasses at Night is spy rock for its sense of the erotic power of wearing sunglasses when you are indoors and it is not bright out. AC/DC's Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap is spy rock. The album cover of Def Leppard's Pyromania, featuring an explosion in a high-rise seen through the crosshairs of a rifle scope, is spy rock. The Peter Gunn theme and Johnny Rivers' Secret Agent Man are, of course, seminal spy rock, as are the James Bond theme and the songs particular to each movie, though none more so than A View to a Kill by Duran Duran and Live and Let Die by Wings. The theme music by Vangelis for the movie Blade Runner also orbits distantly the spy rock constellation, even though Harrison Ford's character was not a spy. The best theme song in the genre is, however, the theme to the movie Buckaroo Banzai. Even considering that Buckaroo Banzai, though a scientist, crime fighter, and rock star, was also not a spy. Similarly, Elvis Costello's Watching the Detectives is spy rock. And because of these anomalous examples, a word about the difference between spies and detectives is in order. The protagonist of Patrick McGoohan's British TV series The Prisoner is a spy known only as Number Six. When he informs the intelligence agency for which he works that he is quitting, he is kidnapped and kept prisoner in a surreal village. The series chronicles his attempts to escape as well as to discover the meaning of his prison. It includes the revelation that what prompted our hero to quit the intelligence agency in the first place was his discovery of this very village. In other words, the reason he got thrown in jail is that he found out about the existence of the jail. Which leads us to the key distinction in my mind between spies and detectives. A spy is in the service of his government. That is, until such time as his government chooses to betray him. Thus, his imprisonment may become actual, but it is always at least potential. His employer, or jailer, is simply the most good of any number of possible governments, until he discovers it not to be. At which point, he becomes his most heroic. At which point, he becomes fallen. At which point, he becomes a detective. Because a detective is in the service of nothing except himself. His job is to discover the truth. For money. He will follow the truth down its tortuous path, no matter how many of his illusions are shattered along the way. And a detective differs from even a fallen spy in that the detective has been fallen from the start. The spy lives in fancy hotels in foreign cities at public expense, fighting for the security of his home. The detective lives, for the most part, in his office, where he keeps his files and his whiskey, because at the end of the day, he has no home worth returning to. A spy may occasionally be compelled to crawl around through the grass, but far more often he passes unseen because of the anonymity afforded him by modern urban overcrowding. He goes from city to airplane to city again, never alone, and so his journey is wearying, but never cathartic. And therefore, even though he is aristocratic, he never has the pleasure of being ennobled. He never knows solitude, only the isolation of the jail cell or the submarine. James Bond is more often underwater than he is in the desert. When he is caught out in the Egyptian desert, pursued by the metal-toothed heavy known as Jaws, he immediately enters a catacomb. And his constant imprisonment is a kind of crucible in which is forged the transcending freedom of acting like a sociopath. The sociopath is, of course, a hero of English language fiction, literary and otherwise, in settings as diverse as the CIA, the Wild West, and the California suburbs. And for this reason, the Beatles' Helter Skelter, stolen as it was by Charles Manson, is a progenitor of spy rock. And because they stole it back, and because of their name, but not because of any of their songs, the band U2 is spy rock. Adam Ant's Stand and Deliver is spy rock. David Bowie's China Girl is spy rock for its evocation of the same love of oriental adventure that colors Graham Greene's The Quiet American. Bowie's Major Tom is also spy rock via the space program, like the CIA, a quasi-governmental cowboy enterprise. Queen's Another One Bites the Dust is clearly spy rock, as is Talking Heads' Life During Wartime, a founding father of the genre in its most specific sense. Missing Persons' Life is So Strange, Howard Jones' What Is Love Anyway, and Joy Division's Love Will Tear Us Apart, again, are a sort of interstellar cloud of alienation surrounding the spy rock constellation. See also Al Stewart's The Year of the Cat, which has the right tone, even though it has nothing to do whatsoever with spying. Life in the Fast Lane by the Eagles, Private Eyes by Hall & Oates, and Band on the Run by Paul McCartney and Wings are spy rock. Rockwell's I Always Feel Like Someone's Watching, Somebody's Watching Me. Foreigner's Agent Provocateur album title. And the cover art for the 12-inch single of Falco's On the Run, our spy rock. Peter Gabriel's Shock the Monkey is, as you will gather if you are beginning to get a sense of how this works, spy rock. Both the Rolling Stones' Undercover and Don Henley's All She Wants to Do Is Dance, with their whispers of Latin American nefariousness, are spy rock. Simon and Garfunkel's Gentle El Condor Pasa. Connected via its title's noun to Operation Condor, the Chilean government's assassination program, and thereby to the date September 11th, 1973, which some say inspired the date of the 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center, which inaugurated bin Laden's reign of terror perched astride his robotic pterodactyl in the skies above New York, is not spy rock, because this is simply too tenuous a connection. But speaking of warmer climes, it must be said that the original incarnation of the clothing store Banana Republic, when it sold safari-themed attire, allowed spy rock to exist. Its fictitious setting, the Banana Republic, is spy rock because of that old standby, the erotic power of travel and cocktails. But as all things must, the Banana Republic has gone hopelessly first world. The spy rock constellation is faded, the orbits deteriorated, the genre all but exhausted. For the sake of neat categories and clean endings, let us date the end of spy rock to the event I alluded to earlier in 1986, when the Beastie Boys were officially issued a license to ill. While my almost relation, the actual spy, Dr. Ray S. Klein, was alive, I heard the true story of a vacation in the 1950s in West Germany. My grandmother and grandfather were with Ray and his wife. They were driving through the Black Forest. They stopped in the middle of the vast, empty woods, and Ray walked to an anonymous tree where he pushed a button. A hitherto unseen gate, camouflaged to look like underbrush, swung mechanically aside, and the four friends spent the weekend at a secret U.S. intelligence facility, which rivaled any resort. After Ray died, I read on the old reliable internet these facts, that he was known in intelligence circles as a bon vivant, that years after the Cuban Missile Crisis at a social event in Havana, he was able to joke with Castro about the CIA's attempts to assassinate him, and that in 1980, around the time of his postscript to me about the occasional necessity of crawling around through the grass, he went to Cambodia as a foreign policy advisor to Reagan, where he paid a clandestine visit to the jungle headquarters of Pol Pot. Ray's intention was to aid Pol Pot in his war against the Cambodian government. China backed Pol Pot in this effort, and the U.S. cooperated to appease China to ensure that China's power would continue to counterbalance that of the Soviet Union. 5 years earlier, as you may recall, Pol Pot and his Khmer Rouge had renamed the year 1975 the year zero and murdered 1.5 million people. Which rather makes George Pulte's elaborate taxonomy of his library seem trivial. This obsessive reorganization of the detritus of one's browsings is not the most momentous of intellectual activity, particularly not when there are mass murderers to be assisted in their obsessive reorganization of the calendar. Ray died in 1996, but before he did, he suffered from a disease called Alzheimer's. After retiring from the CIA, and many years later from teaching, he had struggled to continue publishing his monthly Estimate of the World Situation, to a dwindling audience of intelligence diehards camouflaged among the leafy streets of Arlington, Virginia, until finally he succumbed to oblivion in his own house, the aged spy master, his secrets forgotten, tottering like Lear in a gray realm. But of course, not precisely like Lear. Not in the end 100% the exact same dramatic situation as the tragedy of King Lear by William Shakespeare. Perhaps it is the elusive dramatic situation number 37, for I can find no mention of it in Pulte's book. I leave you tonight with the black hole at the center of the Spyrock constellation, the one song and one image which define the genre conclusively. The song is called Twilight Zone by a band called Golden Earring. You can hit that now. Ah, yes. And the picture was taken in Illinois in or around 1984. You can almost tell it's me, in spite of my disguise.
Somewhere in the morning, we'll tell all those guys thought and realize that eternal fate has turned its back.
We're back here in Jonathan Colton's amazing submarine. We're actually speaking to you from the boiler room right now because the ballroom is closed to clear out the porpoises. I think the trick is that they need to be kept in water.
It's a dirty job.
If you enjoyed that lecture from David Guion that you just heard, and you happen to be a radio programmer at a radio station, then you might go to prx.org. That's the publicradioexchange.org. Where a radio-friendly version of that lecture is available for your download and purchase and broadcasting to people who do not have their sets tuned to receive broadcasts from submarines. There are a few people out there still who do not have that technology. And PRX has been a great friend to the Little Gray Book Lectures, and we hope to be doing all sorts of projects with them in the future, including commemorative figurines and that sort of thing. Before we sign off and get back to work on this theme song, I guess it is, I wanted to maybe hear another song by another one of the musical guests who were not you, Jonathan.
Yeah.
And these were hot and hazy.
Sure were.
Oh, boy, you can really hear that laugh echo here in the boiler room, especially over the sounds of the engine. And
it's a metal room.
You seem to have quite a few three-year-old children running around in here. I don't know whether that's...
I don't know what that is. There supposedly are not any three-year-old children on the submarine, but occasionally you'll hear...
I don't think the Coast Guard believed you any more than I do now. So, but Hot and Hazy did a terrific song also about spies, which suits the theme of this lecture that we're fondly remembering at this moment.
Yes.
Secrets of the Secret Agents.
Yes.
Hot and Hazy.
Spy Rock has not died, ladies and gentlemen. It's just gone underground.
They were searching for the blue-collar man, blue jeans, hot sweat, and a sunburnt tan, taking him back to their homes. While their husbands thought they were alone, lives of leisure these ladies did lead, thanks to their husbands' greed. But lacking in love and thus bored to death, these ladies sought adventures in sex. The ladies thought he was a regular guy, but he was a spy. The ladies thought he was a regular guy, but he was a spy. The ladies thought he was a regular guy as he worked hard on their telephone wire. So they would greet him scantily clad, for he was a handsome young lad. Their husband's man in government, both senators and advisors to the president. And since these ladies had nothing to do with their day, well, they knew where the keys to their husband's desk lay. Yes, the ladies thought he was a regular guy, but he was a spy. The ladies thought he was a regular guy, but
you know, Jonathan, as we depart now, I'd like to remind people that we are coming back for lecture number 30. This will be happening on February 24 at Galapagos Art Space, and it'll be on the subject of the U.S. presidency or presidents. What are they good for? Absolutely nothing. Say it again. Or what else is buried in Grant's tomb besides his beard? And or who was the only three-year-old president? We're still working on quite a few things in this lecture, but I think you'll enjoy yourself and you'll have a good time, and I hope you will come by. All of the information is available on our website. Now, as for this theme song, I remember something else from the Secret Agent lecture that we did, which were a series of spy broadcasts that happen on shortwave frequencies throughout the world, where spy controllers will read out lists of code numbers to spies all around the world. Maybe since you can't sing while playing the song, maybe we could play some of those broadcasts
while you're
playing, and maybe that will sound good.
I'll give that a shot.
Yeah, let's give that a twirl. I happen to have it queued up here on the Aqua Memory phone. So.
Oh, don't touch the Aqua Memory phone.
No. I've been watching you very carefully, and I think you just turn this, and then the memory comes out with the water storage cells.
It's a very sensitive instrument, is the only thing.
Yeah, but I figure if you just turn this thing.
Yeah, I'll take
it. Well, you can't play the melodica with one hand.
Well, I'm going to this time.
I always said that.
No.
I told you couldn't do it.
Why didn't you just
let me dial this thing
up? All right, dial it up.
I'll just turn this thing. Move this lever.
Acht, drei, vier, null, sechs, eins, zwei, acht, eins.